Succession number 9476, reel number 1.
Mr. Boone, reel 1. Could we start off by perhaps you telling me when you were born?
I was born on December the 23rd, 1897.
And can you tell me something about your parents?
My father was a seagoing engineer. He was born in London. His family, his paternal side, came from Northumberland. Embleton. His grandfather was a gamekeeper there with Lord Grey. And John Boone left Embleton sometime before 1814, went to London and found employment there. And I really think when he went there, he went to some relatives, and I've been trying to trace them ever since, but I can't find the link at the moment.
And your mother?
My mother is a native of Northumberland, North Shields, and her father was quite a energetic sort of fellow. He came off a very, very wealthy family. In fact, one of them was an MP in Tynemouth in 1850. But his father was the black sheep of the family. By virtue of that, he was disowned. And my grandfather never spoke of his own family. But he inherited a lot of their very valuable characteristics, because they amassed. In 1894, and I've got papers here I can show, they had a business of ship insurance, and they had 28 millions. Fancy, 28 millions in 1894.
That's a lot of it.
And they had a family of 8, 2 girls, 2 boys, I'm sorry, one became an MP, and they had 8 girls, and they were known as the Golden Dumplings. Each was very fat and very short, and each had a legacy, a dowry of £10,000. Needless to say, they weren't long in finding suitors.
Did your family inherit any of that wealth?
No. My grandfather would not allow anyone to speak of his own family. He was so disgusted at the behaviour that needed out to him.
In what way was he disgusted?
Well, they ignored him. He wasn't accepted as a member of the family.
You said he was the black sheep, didn't you?
Because his father was the black sheep.
Yeah. Why was that?
He was a seafaring man. These people owned ships. And he lost his first ship, owned a neglect of some sort. And the second ship, he was in Le Havre. And they found him dead in his bunk, together with the dog, killed by smoke. And it was rather suspected he had been partaken of too much beverage.
To return to your immediate parents, can you tell me the size of your family?
Size? Over the years, there was a total of 11. There were 6 girls before I arrived, and I was looked upon as a messiah. And after that, there were five boys.
You say you were looked upon as the messiah. Why was that?
Well, you see, there are 6 girls, and they wanted a boy, and when I arrived, I thought it was marvellous. I think they lived to regret it because I kept them awake.
You said that there were 11 children. Did they all survive?
Let me see. 3 sisters survived, and two boys.
And the others died in infancy?
Most of them died in infancy. I had a brother who died about 17 of age, 17 years of age.
And how did he die? Was that in the war?
Pardon?
Did he die in the war?
Oh, no, he was... No, he died. It was after the war he died. He was quite young.
Where were your family living at this time?
Living in North Shields, Northumberland.
What would you say conditions at home were like? Were you very overcrowded, or...?
We were much better off than most people. By present-day standards, I would say it was very poor. For instance, we had no bathroom. We had no proper facilities for bathing. We had a coal fire with a range and washing facilities were difficult. Cooking was entirely on a coal fire. Generally speaking, we were a very happy group. I didn't feel of any shortcomings at all. I kept myself very busy. I was always busy doing something and thoroughly enjoyed myself. And we were a very happy family.
Did your mother have any help in running the family, or did she have to do it by herself?
Oh, no. My mother had no help at all. Not at all. She managed herself. We used to bake our own bread twice a week, perhaps a stone of flour, and bake our own bread, cook all our own meals, and... we had to buy clothes, of course.
Would you say you were well provided for?
I would say yes, we were. We had all we wanted. We didn't have a plentiful supply, but we had met our needs, and we were very happy, well clothed.
Can we turn now to your own education?
My education, well, my education, let me see. I went to an elementary school and I left at the age of 14. But prior to that, at age of 12, I started to work at the local shop, and I worked from 5 o'clock in the evening till 8 o'clock at night, and on Fridays from 5 o'clock till 11 at night, and on a Saturday from 8 o'clock in the morning perhaps till 1 o'clock on a Sunday morning. And for that I got 2 and 3 pence per week. Then I had a better...
What duties? You said it was an errand boy. What did that involve?
Just delivering groceries, pushing the barrow, and weighing out flour, weighing out sugar. Perhaps a quarter of a ton of flour to put into half stone bags, or 100 weight of sugar to put in pound bags. And all the week you were busy filling containers. And then at the weekend you were busy delivering goods. And then there were the butchers, which was round the corner, and I started at 8 o'clock in the morning till about 10 to 9, going round the houses collecting the orders, and went back in the evening and worked about 2 hours, and normal hours on a Saturday. It was a much easier job, and it was more... I was paid half a crown a week.
You got a pay rise. Did those extra hours of work interfere with your education, do you think?
No, not at all. Not at all. No. Oh, no. You see, I was at an elementary school and we didn't get homework. And then when I left school, the post office, the general post office, wanted some staff, and I joined. The headmaster offered me the opportunity of going to work at the General Post Office as a telegraph messenger, which I did. And whilst I was there, I attended night classes. And throughout the whole of my life, without exception, I could say, I've always attended a class of some sort. In the early days, it was technical education. And then I joined the workers' educational. History, psychology, philosophy, and then I joined the University Extension Movement. And when I was in Manchester, biology, botany, English literature, anything that appealed to me, I joined it because I used to enjoy it.
Can you tell me a little bit about your work for the post office, please?
I worked for the post office. I was on the internal work. We used to look after telephones, the main telephones, fit telephones, and then I became clerk of works.
Before that, though, when you first started, you weren't an engineer, were you? You started off as something more basic than that.
I was like an apprentice. The duties were very elementary. Of course, the science of technology was elementary, and we spent more time cleaning things than looking after them.
Could you tell me about your duties as a telegraph boy?
Well, as a telegraph boy, the conditions were very strict. You were given a uniform, which you had to keep in very good order. Every morning when you arrived, you had to polish your buttons, polish your belt, and every Monday you were subject to drill by a military sergeant, and we used to have drill for the first hour every Monday morning with a carbine, and we had to right about turn, quick march, and when we were on delivering telegrams, we weren't allowed to run. We had to walk smartly and erect.
Why do you think they bothered to drill you like that? What was the purpose of it?
So you could wear your uniform with credit and in a smart sort of way.
And what you said, you drilled with a carbine, is that right, with a gun?
Little carbine, you know. March down, left, right, up. And one of the fellas turned around and gave me a wallop on the back of the back of the ear, and I could still got the marker with the sight of the gun. And then if you committed a misdemeanor of any sort, you were fined. Penny, tuppence or threepence. Your wage was 5 cents a week. And you got a halfpenny for every telegram above 60. And at the end of the week, your total earnings of 5 and threepence halfpenny were sent to your parents. And quite a lot of the boys prior to that had pocketed the threepence halfpenny, and so they sent these chits out to circumvent that, and then all this money where the fines was put into a fund. At the end of the year, they awarded a prize for smartness and efficiency, and it so happened I won that prize.
And what happened as a result of that?
By virtue of that, the engineering department wanted a boy, an apprentice, and I was recommended, and I got the post. And I started on the post office engineering department as an apprentice. It was called a youth in training. I learned the art of telephone engineering.
Perhaps before we go into that, you could tell me what the prize was that you won.
The prize was a fountain pen, and a fountain pen and a book of poems, I think. I give these away, you see, some essays by Ruskin.
See, and now perhaps we could turn to your youth and training. What did that consist of at first?
Youth and training? Well, you accompanied a skilled man, and in the process of being with him, you picked up what he knew. But I found that the knowledge of the staff was very, very poor indeed. And I started going to night classes, and that's where I really learned about telephone engineering at night classes.
You say their knowledge was very poor. What made you think their knowledge was poor as a young lad learning the trade?
Well, you could go on a fault. Now, if you are a good electrical engineer, and somebody tells you they're having a defect of some sort, by your training, you ought to know what to look for. But if you get men who go on to a job and they start poking here and poking there, does this work? Does that work? Working in pairs, does this work? Does that work? You know at once, these men know nothing about it. And that was the state of the staff. The rising generation to which I belong were the first that were really technically trained.
You said you went to night school. Did that cost you money?
No, it was run by the post office. Yeah, oh yes.
And how long did that course last for?
It lasted from about September to right through to March.
And did you have to sit an examination at the end of it?
Yes, I had my examination at the end of every term. I was very fortunate. I always got a first class pass.
When you passed this examination, did that affect your salary at all?
Well, we had to sit the City and Guilds examination. The college examination didn't count. And we were encouraged to go into the city for City and Guilds examinations. And I went in for them and obtained them. I obtained them, and for each first class certificate, I got a shilling.
On your wages?
Yeah, shilling per week. That was a lot of money. So there were only three examinations you could pass at that time: magnetism and electricity, telephony and telegraphy. I sat all three and got three first class passes. 3 years, of course.
So this would be, what age would this take you up to be now?
It took me up then when I was called up in the army, or called up in the Royal Flying Corps.
Whilst you were at night school gaining your certificates and your City and Guilds, what were you doing during the day? What did your job consist of?
I was doing telephone maintenance, going around repairing telephones.
Can you tell me something about that? What sort of things would go wrong with them?
Well, a rather curious thing, the faults were repetitive. They were inherent in the mechanism and the construction of things, and inherent in the characteristics of things. For instance, you had a conductor carrying the positive element of a battery, and over a period that conductor deteriorated by reason of the positive current flowing through it. We're talking about corrosion, and why is it a conductor carrying a positive current deteriorates? Now, on external lines, we have the A and B line. And if you've got a positive on the A line, and there happens to be a joint in that line, the moisture gets in, and the positive current flows and forms like a voltaic cell, and it destroys the wire. So there was an old trick. You used to swap the battery round and put the positive on the B leg, and then the chemical transference of the material goes back and heals the wound.
Yeah, it reverses, does it?
Reverses the conditions.
So that was a common fault, was it?
That was a trick they used to use. Oh yes, that was along here with the seafront. You see, you had a joint and the sea breezes full of salt, and was that ideal conditions for voltaic action.
Were there many more telephone lines then than there are now?
There were very, very few. Now, for instance, in North Shields, we'll take Whitley Bay. Whitley Bay, which is, shall we say, 1920. They had only 400 lines. Now they've got about 4,000. And the same with North Shields. There were less than 500 telephones in North Shields, and now there are several thousands. Oh yes, much more today.
In your job, did you have to travel around much to sort out faults, or was it mainly done at the exchange?
Now then, I was appointed clerk of works.
When was that?
First of all, about 1924. On a local exchange. Then I became clerk of works in Newcastle. I was clerk of works on on some. As a matter of fact, I was the first automatic exchange, public exchange in Northumberland. I supervised it. I was clerk of works at Newcastle. I was clerk of works on three jobs there, and then I went out in the country and we installed the first public automatic exchange in Northumberland. And this was installed at a place called Longhoughton. And the reason for that was the local lady who looked after the local switchboard, which was connected to the Earl Grey's residence, she was listening to their private conversation and making it known to the public. And Earl Grey, who was Deputy Postmaster General, arranged for an automatic exchange to put into his village to circumvent that interference.
You know that for a fact, do you?
Pardon?
You know that for a fact. That's
yes.
Yeah. If we can just take you back before the First World War, I asked you if your job entailed you going out to look after the lines, or was it one that was more or less a desk job?
My job was, I wasn't on an external work. I was on internal work, and the external work was very elementary. It was very basic, but the internal work, you had to have a knowledge of circuits, you had to be able to read a diagram, you had to be able to draw a diagram. And when somebody said there was a fault on the line, you could run the circuit through your head, through the diagram, and you could tell where the fault was. We got so expert at this. In an automatic exchange with perhaps three floors, in each floor about 300 yards long, and each floor has equipment on it, and you go from A to B to C and D, and if you get a fault, and if you know your stuff, you know your diagram, you can pinpoint which floor the fault's on, and practically you've got about three things to look at
before you actually go there and look yourself.
You used to go, you knew where to go by reason of your training, by your technical knowledge, and a rather curious thing was you could remember an intricate electrical diagram in the same way that people could remember a poem.
Right. Can we now move to away from your employment for a moment? I'll just ask you if you had any sort of military experience before the First World War. I mean, you've already mentioned you were paraded when you were in the GPO by a sergeant major. Where did he come from? The sergeant major who...
All the postmen in the old days were ex-servicemen or ex-naval men. And in the general post office, you had recruiting sergeants, drill sergeants, acting as postmen.
So the person who actually was drilling you as a young lad there was not actually a sergeant from the army. He was an ex-sergeant, was he?
Ex-army. Employed by the post office.
Apart from that experience of discipline, did you have any proper military training before?
None whatever. I wasn't even in the Boy Scouts. Oh, none at all.
As it drew nearer to 1914 and 1914 itself, was there any anticipation on your part of war breaking out? Were you aware of the tensions?
Not the slightest. In fact, amongst the youngs, when the war started and the Zeps started raiding, I saw quite a lot of Zeps. I used to turn out and watch. I could see them in the sky. I saw one. I saw two brought down. And the war to us was a form of excitement. We weren't perturbed about it in any way.
Yes, I was going to ask you if you could actually remember the day that war did break out. Remember what?
No,
you
I just can't. I can't remember when war broke out. No, I can't. But I remember quite a lot after it happened.
You said that you were excited by the war breaking out. What was your immediate reaction to join up? Were you old enough to join up at that time?
Oh no! Oh no! No, I wasn't old enough. You see, I was automatically enlisted by virtue of my age in the Derby scheme. and I wore an armband, a blue and white armband, to indicate I was on special duties, and by a blue and white armband, and by reason of that, my calling up was delayed for 1 year.
Why do you think you had to wear a blue and white armband? What was the purpose of that?
Well, people would know you were of military age when you're marching about, and if you had this, you knew you weren't slacking. You didn't get the white feather put in the lapel of your coat.
Did you ever see that happen to anyone?
No, I didn't.
Did you ever hear of it happening to
I've people? Heard of it happening, yeah. I've never met anybody. Well, it didn't happen to me.
Had you any idea what the war would be like when it first broke out? You said you were excited.
Not the faintest idea. You see, we lived we were isolated up here in those early days, and we led rather formal, secluded kind of life.
Can we just turn to your job during the war? Did it change in any way once war had broken
yes,
out?
Yes, in the sense we priorities were developed. Military circuits, naval circuits, hospitals, doctors, nursing homes, all had special first attention. The indicators were marked with red, so if an indicator dropped and nobody could see it was red, she would answer before anybody else. That was the operator.
Can you think of any other changes that that took place?
Yes, we in the early days of the war, we were on permanent duty at the exchange in case anything happened, and then they got accustomed to this, and then discontinued the idea. And I can't remember any other changes. No, just went on normally.
You say you were on permanent duties. That you mean a 24-hour day rota?
You were on a 12-hour rota, yeah. Looking at the exchange in case a bomb dropped, you see. But of course, it didn't happen. There was a lot of fears at the beginning of the war, which never. Of course, we were at this time out here. This is the nearest point to Germany. And at the front mouth of the river, we had a battery of gun, 15-inch guns. And the people here thought it was an obvious target, but there was no scare.
Did the Zeppelins raids that you mentioned earlier on in passing, did they increase in tension, do you think, about that?
It created a firm form of alertness, shall we say. There was no panic. And we had several raids, and I remember we had a raid at Colour Courts. They came to bomb the wireless station. And then they dropped a bomb adjacent to the telephone exchange, and all the indicators fell down. And the operators were blown off their seats. And these girls managed to regain their seats, pushed the 400 indicators up, and started answering all the frantic calls of the military and the Navy. And both these girls, by virtue of their duty and resourcefulness, were awarded OBE.
Ought to clarify one point there. The indicators, was that a sort of early form, instead of having a light flash?
The early form of indicator was a shutter on a hinge. It was kept in position by an armature latch. And when you ran, the latch lifted and the hinged armature dropped.
I see, and that alerted the operator to that line. Right, can you tell me, just to go back to the Zeppelin raids for a moment, did you actually witness the Zeppelin raid? Did you actually see one?
I wasn't in the Zeppelin raid, but they dropped bombs at the nearby wireless station, as I say, and the drop bombs at South Shields, and the drop bombs in the shipyards in Wall's End, and they didn't do much damage, though. They were 25-pound bombs, you see.
So they weren't very effective, you think?
No, not very effective.
What precautions were taken against Zeppelin raids?
People had to shield all the lights, and they had to have effective coverings for all the windows. And when a raid was expected, the pressure of the gas was lowered and the flame used to go down, and people knew there was things happening, and most of the people were advised to go into an external building of some sort, perhaps a washhouse or a hut at the bottom of the garden, get away from where there was a danger of the roof falling in on top of you. And then of course we had rationing.
Before you go into rationing, how are these instructions disseminated? Was that through the newspapers or public notices? How are these recommendations for precautions actually spread amongst the public?
There were the newspapers in themselves. They were controlled to a great extent by the government, and they issued all sorts of communiques in the papers, through the papers, and people used to read these. Of course, everyone in those days was obtained a tally upon a daily paper. And there was no communication like wireless or anything like that at all. It hadn't started, of course, in those days.
Did you remember reading reports of Zeppelin raids in the papers?
Oh, yes. There wasn't any detail, but it would indicate that something had happened in such a peculiar area, but no detail. It was later on that you got to know about it after some...